On the way over here, I was just reading a very nice verse composed by Srila Rupa Goswami. He says, Tunde tandavani latim de tante tundavali labhaye parna proda kadambani katayate karnarbhude pyas vaham cheta prangana sangani vijayate sardendriyanam kutim no jane janita ki adhir amitai krishneti varnadvayi. Krishnaiti Varnadvayi, in these two syllables, Krishna, how much nectar is there? No jane janita ki adhir amitai. Krishnaiti Varnadvayi, how much nectar is there in the holy name of Krishna? When the holy name of Krishna is chanted, it appears to be dancing within the mouth. Tandavani. And we then desire to have many, many mouths. And when the name enters the holes of the ears, we desire many millions of ears. And when the holy name dances in the courtyard of the heart, it conquers the activities of the mind, and their senses become inert. This is Rupa Goswami's realization about the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. How much nectar there is. If I had millions of mouths and millions of ears, then I could chant and hear the holy name of Krishna. Otherwise, with just one mouth and two ears, how frustrating it is. It's so much nectar and I only have 2 years and one mouth. Like the gopis, they were complaining that this Brahma is prosaic. He really doesn't have any sense of how to do things. Who made him the creator? He makes eyelids so that when you're seeing Krishna, they blink, the eyes blink, and then your seeing is interrupted. So what kind of creator is he? In this way, Rupa Goswami is also, how much nectar is there in the holy name that when we chant and we hear, we wish we had thousands of tongues and thousands of ears, because the holy name is dancing. And when it dances in the heart, then all of the senses are completely conquered. The yogis are trying to conquer their senses by discipline, by austerity, by starvation. They starve the senses and they won't have the power to act. Control the senses by extreme tapasya, force of austerity. But Rupa Goswami says when the holy name takes over, then the senses, they become inert. They're no longer materially active because they're drowning in the nectar of the holy name of the Lord. In this way, he's appreciating the holy name. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appreciated how nice this, nicely expressed Sri Rupa Goswami, how nicely expressed. Well, in the beginning, Duradaiva Mijushami Hajami Namara. We're not very attached to the holy name. We're attracted to other things. We're distracted. It seems like a big chore to chant the holy name. But when one gets taste, then it becomes like nectar. And how does one get a taste? By chanting. We were discussing the matter the other day, what happiness is in goodness. Well, this is happiness in goodness. Yattaragre vishamiva pariname mritopana. A happiness that in the beginning is like poison, but at the end is like nectar. Yattaragre Taragre Vishamiva Parinami Dopam. Tatsukam Satvikam Prokam Atma Bhuti Prasadi. This brings about self-realization. And the happiness and passion, Vishayendriya Samyoga Yatta Agre Mirtopam Parinami Vishamiva Tatsukam Raja Samsvatam. Happiness in the beginning is just like nectar. By the touch of the senses with the sense objects, seeing something, touching something, hearing something, tasting something, it appears just like nectar. And at the end, it's just like poison. This is happiness in the mode of passion. At the present moment, the modern society is cultivating happiness in the mode of passion, or happiness in the mode of ignorance. Happiness in the mode of ignorance is described that in the beginning and in the end, it's poison. Let's see, who is that? Yadagre cha anubandhe cha. Sukham mohanam atmanaha nidralasya pramadottam tattama samudra. At the beginning and the end, it's misery. Sukham mohanam atmanaha comes from total bewilderment of the soul. Nidralasya from laziness and sleep and madness. Pramada. That's happiness in the mode of ignorance. And people are cultivating this. Going drinking, and drinking means mode of ignorance. You become crazy, or you just become dull. Or you take some other drug, and you're crazy. Or you become dull. Or they do foolish things with mode of ignorance. Or the mode of passion, trying to gratify. This is considered what life is for. But life is meant for Brahma Jigyasa, for spiritual advancement, and finally for Krishna consciousness. So our Krishna consciousness movement is trying to give balance to human society. They're simply concerned with the material necessities. Material necessities are necessities. We need to eat, we need to sleep, and so on. But that's not everything. For them it becomes everything. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. It's a whole life. So that's out of balance. We need to eat, we need to sleep, but we need to give attention to the real, to the higher purpose of life, spiritual realization. Otherwise it's a failure. If all I did, what did you do today? I ate. I slept. Oh, that's not very good. Oh, but I had sex. And animals all over. The hogs and dogs and having, there are no hogs in London, but the dogs and cats. So what did you do today that made you better than a dog? I did something to fight against terrorism or protect the country. The dogs are doing that also. They have their claws. So, what are you doing that makes you better than a dog? Well, actually, now that you mention it. So, the dog needs to eat. We also need to eat. But the dogs and cats have no opportunity, no equipment for spiritual realization. That's the human prerogative. If we don't use it, then we're animals only. And that's the modern civilization, an animalistic culture. Trying to refine the business. Better eating, better sleeping, better sex. Better fighting. So, life is not meant for that. Life is meant for Krishna consciousness. These bodily necessities, that's just keep them going, but the real purpose should be pursued. Otherwise, the human life is a failure. Prabhu Vastava and Bhoda Jata, Yavana Jigyasata Atmapakta. So we shouldn't allow our human lives to be a failure. We should try to save others from wasting their human lives. That's the purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement. And I heard you wanted to have some questions tonight, so I'll stop there and see what kind of questions you have. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Krishna.
Yesterday someone asked me, why did something from the Bhagavad Gita, so much good came out of it? Why did something that was trying to do so much good come from something so bad, like a battlefield and a war? So why did the Bhagavad Gita have to go to the battlefield as opposed to somewhere peaceful and tranquil?
That even on the battlefield something good can come. We know that, you know, when things are peaceful and tranquil, then you'll have a nice discussion. But when things are stretched to the limit, when there's tension and so on, tension and war, something good can come from there. Very suitable for the modern world. There's war and fighting and tension everywhere. In our personal affairs and our national affairs. The Bhagavad Gita is very suitable. Apart from that, it makes for good drama. Krishna's setting things up. Who would go to see a movie where all that happens is kind of the birds fly in the sky and people have a peaceful, quiet discussion? Nobody's interested in that. They want, you know, it has to start with a murder or somebody driving off a cliff or, you know, something dramatic. So Bhagavad Gita is dramatic. There's a dramatic limit situation where everyone is, you know, brothers and cousins, and they're all completely against one another, but at the same, you know, it's a fantastically powerful confrontation. And in the middle of that, you get the spiritual illumination. That happens in our lives also. When do we usually get some spiritual realization? When things are tough. You know, when you see yourself in perplexity, well, if I go this way, I'm in trouble. If I go that way, I'm in trouble. If I go the third way, I'm in trouble. If I don't do anything, I'm in trouble. Then you need to find some way out of all that. Then you start thinking, well, there has to be something, you know, a new solution. Otherwise, you just try the old ones again. So, under such circumstances, people become Krishna conscious. I realized that I was, you know, wasting a no useful, no meaningful way to turn. And I have to turn to a Krishna.
Mm-hmm. And one more question that baffled me is people that might believe in Al Qaeda and the Jihad thing, they say that it's their duty to you know, like, stop the Western end and the non, not really sure what they believe in, but, you know, that kind of that kill push kind of factor. we say our duty is, you know, to help others, and everyone has duty. So what differentiates our duty as opposed to, because they would just say it's their duty.
Well, it's good to know that they have some good ideas. The terrorists and the non-terrorists, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish between them, the terrorists and the anti-terrorists, are both on the same platform. They're both interested in exploiting the material world. That's the actual position. The Yes, they're both interested. This business that, you know, it's all for Islam and so on, is not, has been overplayed. You know, you speak to people and all the wars in the world have been fought over religion. And, you know, it's, that's so easy to falsify. Let's see, the Vietnam War was fought over religion. The Korean War was fought over religion. Falklands thing was over religion. World War II was over religion. World War I was over religion. American Civil War, Spanish-American War, Mexican-American War, these were all about religion. It's all about sense gratification. It's all about sense gratification. And it's been a tactic since a long time to portray people as, you know, religious fanatics or as, you know, some sort of crazy something or other, bent on destroying civilization or, you know, irrational madmen, da-da-da-da-da, religious fanatics. But there sometimes may be disagreements that actually arise over religious issues. But I don't think that patrolling is really a religious issue. Otherwise, from what I told, jihad originally in Islam has to do with making war on one's own impurities. And I suppose one might understand how. Anyway, we won't get into that. But the entire picture of religious fanatics who are trying to overthrow the civilized world is really baloney. You know, it's such a shabby tale. But taking it that there are at least some religious fanatics out there in the Islamic world as in other religious communities. So this comes from, you can say, third class spiritual understanding. Let's take it that they're sincere devotees of Allah. So, but then they have to be third class. What's a third class devotee? A third class devotee sees himself and God. God is with us. And God is not any place else. God is in the temple, God is in the garden, God is in the mandir. And others, we don't care about them, or we have no regard for them. Second class devotee, he sees that there's God, there's other devotees of God, then there are the materialists or atheists, and the innocent persons. So he makes friends with the devotees, he worships God, he opposes the demonic men. In this way. And the innocent he tries to help. And the first class devotee sees everyone as being a devotee of God. That's the highest stage of consciousness. Now that Paramahansa stage can't be imitated, but at least we should try to come to the second platform to recognize the godly and the demonic and stand with the godly persons, avoid the demonic, and try to help the innocent. Terrorizing innocent people is not godly life. Even some of the nuns. Further question along these lines?
I did have one.
Just as a matter of following that up, the so-called religious fanatical terrorists are just not in the same league as people who start wars against small countries on false pretenses and kill 250,000 people, mostly women and children. That's just not on the same level. The two are not on the same level. you might want to take that into account before we go off on a crusade against Islamic fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Let's squeeze one more question. I was trying to explain Van Ashram to somebody, a Jewish friend of mine, and then when I started telling him a bit about the Brahmachari Ashram, he kind of interrupted me and made me actually question myself. How is it that, because in Brahmachari we celebrate, how is it that the ideal, or is it the ideal Krishna consciousness and the Van Ashram we celebrate, like you said, that's a Brahmachari, and then that would be opposing the most natural thing in the material world, which is, you know, making children and stuff and having a family.
The ideal of Krishna consciousness is not to be Brahmachari or Sannyasi, it's to be Krishna conscious.
The ideal state of living. The
ideal state of living is Krishna consciousness.
The ideal ashram?
Ideal ashram is Brahmacharya or Sannyas. If he's Jewish, you can explain to him. It's so much cheaper. Yes. Any sensible person is interested in saving money. Lifelong Brahmacharya we can leave aside, but at least we say that you, in the first stage of life, one should be Brahmacharya. Suppose student life. Well, what's your idea of student? That you just, you know, sleep around with, you know, go from woman to woman and enjoy? And with contraceptive methods? What's that have to do with the most natural thing? You know, unless he's a very strictly religious person, you know, the argument is a little hollow because. Mm. You know, we want to sneak in here with the most natural function, da 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 da. Then we're going to introduce all this latex and other things into the, you know, this most natural function, and we're going to, you know, let's call a spade a spade. It's really cat and dog life, and you're bringing in a religious argument. Unless he's really a strictly religious person, you know. And if he's really a strictly religious person, any strictly religious person controls his sex life. Not that Judaism has, you know, like just go out there and, you know, it feels good, do it. That's not Judaism. In Judaism also, there, you know, there's marriage. There's chastity. There's self-control. There, you know, there are morals. And Judaism is known for ethics and morality. You know, where is that? Control of the sex life. So leaving aside lifelong celibacy, at least for the beginning, before you're married, self-control. We'll talk about lifelong vows later. Let's talk about the first 25. Let's talk about student life. Let's talk about before you're married. Sex or no? No, that's where the real thing is. And if he says, well, then, you know, you're not talking to a person who's serious. His argument just went to hell. It's, well, we want to enjoy our sense gratification. And at the end of life also, I mean, what's your idea? You know, back out in your 80s, you should be, you know, still trying to make a go of it? You know, that's the most natural thing. You know, what's Viagra all about? If you're, you know, just trying to do the most natural thing. They want to keep it going when nature is totally saying, no, 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 sorry, out of the question, forget it. But But, you know, couldn't we, well, how about, you know, there's somehow or other, when nature's saying absolutely no, they're saying, well, come on, let's still go for it. So sannyasa is generally in the last part of life. What's your idea about how man should spend the last time, the last part of his life? Getting married again? Or, you know, having a mistress, or, you know, what's your idea? I mean, children in his 60s? I mean, what's your idea? It's just sensible. The time for having children is when you're young. You know, say 25 to, you know, maximum 50. What, otherwise you're going to have a kid in your 50s so that when you're 70, you know, you're, what, putting him through college or something? You know, it's just sensible. And if you're going to talk about what's natural, let's talk about what's natural. Let's talk about biology and all of that kind of stuff. Natural time to have sex, first of all, assuming we agree that it's within marriage, which we really ought to agree if we're talking about any kind of religion. You know, it's after your student days are over and before old age sets in. So we're saying, okay, before then and after then, forget it. Put it aside. You know, hold it in check and then, you know, ditch it. You know, I don't think you're going to get... You know, but then if we can agree on that much, then we can start talking about whether it might be a good idea to skip the other 25 years. And by the way, are we talking about the most, during those 25 years of married life, are we talking about, you know, just doing what's very natural and letting nature take its course? Or are we talking about family plan? Well, but, you know, you're either on one side of the argument or you're on the other, not both at the same time. Either your argument is, you know, doing what comes naturally and having big families, expensive. Or you're talking about doing something which, you know, interferes with nature's arrangement. Tries to, you know, put things together in a more favorable way somehow. But you're not talking about just doing what's natural. So let's argue one side of the fence or the other, but not both at the same time. Or, you know, one when it's convenient and then the other one when it's convenient. So our position is consistent. When you're a student and you're not married, don't have sex. When you're old and it's, you know, you're too old for that stuff, forget it. Don't try to agitate your mind and somehow regenerate your sensual capabilities. Just, you know, go with nature. Forget it. And go on for something higher. And in the middle, self-control. We're not against sex in marriage, we're for it. But with self-control. Are you against self-control? Is Judaism against self-control? Think we should just be uncontrolled? No? Is our position sensible or not? Is that okay?
Marriage, how to develop or maintain the quality of humanity in the most abominable environments. You know, just an example, like working in sort of finance, banking field.
Well, there's an abominable environment.
and it's an environment that's completely not conducive for anti-egoistic behavior. So how is it?
Anti-egoistic means recognizing that everything is coming from Krishna. Doesn't mean non-competitive. Arjuna was not egotistical. He understood that everything was being done by Krishna. And that he was only acting as Krishna's instrument. That didn't mean that he couldn't be competitive. He was supposed to be competitive. That was his role as Krishna's instrument, to be competitive for Krishna. but to recognize that the capabilities that he had were not because of who he was, but because of Krishna's grace. When Krishna withdrew his power, he couldn't even defeat a batch of cowards now. And when Krishna gave power, he was able to defeat Bhishma, Drona, Karna, so many. Like an ocean of Timangir fish, bigger than whales. And he was able to cross that ocean by the grace of Krishna. So freedom from false ego doesn't mean that I don't know
what to do with it. I guess whatever everybody else wants to do.
That's not real freedom from false ego. Is to know that I have to do my duty as the servant of Krishna. It's not a question of ego, it's a question of service. Not because, and if I succeed, it's not because I'm great, it's because Krishna helped me succeed. And if I fail, it also happens. Not that my ego has to be crushed. They have a sense, they have a different idea of ego. You know, a person who's egotistical is a person who's loud, and
yeah.
You know, and a person who's free from ego is a person who's soft and mushy. But our idea is that either one of those two can be egotistical. They're both identifying with the body. One's thinking, you know, I'm great because I've got this body. The other thing, I'm so bad because I'm this body. But Krishna conscious person knows I'm not this body. I'm spirit soul. I'm serving with Krishna. So he's free from false ego.
Well, just carry on with this question. Sometimes to remain competitive, you have to integrate with their ways and become social and do the things that they do. And that often means, quite often it means, you know, you have to break down principles or something.
No, it doesn't. Actually. And even, you know, people have principles. And actually, people will respect that people have principles. There was a rumor spread during the Third Reich. Hitler's people spread the rumor that he was vegetarian. He wasn't, but it created the image of a person who had like this power of austerity. People actually respect it. If a person is, you know. Says, no, I don't, you know, no, I won't do that. Sorry, that's against my principles. Wow, God has principles. He's 1 out of 10,000. People respect it. And if they don't, it's tough beans. But, yeah, we stand on our principles. Of course, we try to avoid situations where breaking the principles is the norm. But if sometimes it's not possible, you have to be in some situation. But still, you guys can do that. I don't do that. And you know, they may first think, you know, what's with him? But over the long run, just like when I first joined Krishna consciousness, to be vegetarian was like weird. You know, we eat grass or what? Now you tell somebody they're a vegetarian, they say, well, I don't eat white meat. Or I don't eat red meat. Or, you know, it's like cool to be vegetarian. Actually, our principles are principles of character. Well, people may or may not appreciate character, but it has its own value. And intelligent people will appreciate that person's character. Just like a woman, if she's loose, everyone will like her, but no one will respect her.
Mm.
And if she has standards, then, you know, people may not be so happy with her, but they'll respect her. Right?
Has it not seemed sometimes that for them may seem that we're going too far with some of our principles, but they don't see it as a
principle? Fine, they'll see it that way. They're going too far.
Okay.
Do I put in my 8 hours a day? Do I bring in the contracts? Do I, you know, do I punch in the right numbers and come out with the right answer? Okay. Everybody's weird out there. Look at them, they're all weird in some way or another. Well, we can be weird also, from that point of view. But our weirdness makes sense also. That's the difference. Their weird is just weird. We have a philosophy behind it, we have sense behind it, we have advantages behind it. Even if we sacrifice materially, you know, it means I lose some opportunity. All right. Worth it. Price of doing business. If I lose some opportunity, but I keep my integrity. Yeah, that's right. What is integrity? It means turning down opportunities. Right? In business, in politics, there are all these opportunities to cheat, to lie, to steal, to exploit. And if you turn down those opportunities, then they call you a person of integrity. So we want to be people of integrity. That means having principles. That means saying no when everybody else is saying, come on. be sensible, be, you know, get real. Don't be foolish. Okay, we're weird. We turn down the God. That's integrity. Another question?
You know, the devotees in Kazakhstan, for example, is that Krishna's blessing? That, you know, I'm not really sure what happened, but they got that bulldozer and they were treating this family.
It's always Krishna's blessing.
Why would, again, the old question of why did the bad things happen to good people? I know it's
just like Kunti Devi. She was praying to Krishna, and so many catastrophes befell us. They tried to poison my sons with poison cake. They tried the house of lack and setting it on fire. They tried in so many ways to cheat us and kill us and everything. But the benefit was that we had to be completely dependent on you. So actually it was our good fortune. When there's adversity, that's good fortune.
Well, that's bad things happen to us. We should like it, or
like it or not like it, you know. But we should recognize that it's Krishna's mercy. Not that Krishna's mercy is just when everybody glorifies you and everything comes your way, and it works, and it's all, you know. That's Krishna's mercy. And when things go wrong, that's not Krishna's mercy. Things go wrong, that's all also Krishna's mercy. When you fail, that's also Krishna's mercy. It's an opportunity for spiritual advancement. If the purpose of life is self-realization, and if material failure or catastrophe or danger drives me to depend more on Krishna, then is it fortunate or not? Yes.
Maharaj, if Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that everyone's on his path, why do we need to disturb anybody in whatever they're doing?
Yes, a pure devotee thinks like that, the Uttamadhikara, that everybody's serving Krishna and that's the need of preaching. So those who are on that level don't preach. But the rest of us, we see that everyone's serving Krishna, But some are serving directly and some are serving indirectly. Some are serving the government by working in the government offices or serving in the military or doing some government job, and some are serving the government by, you know, pounding bricks in the prison. They're both serving the government, but that forced involuntary service is not very good. Better if they would take a law-abiding path and serve happily.
Because a lot of the time at least some of the time when we go out and Harinam or books or something like that, people say, why are you doing this? Just leave us, you know, why are you disturbing everyone? Why do you...
Yeah, because you're just like, suppose there was an epidemic disease. So the doctors go and disturb everyone. Why? You can see that others are suffering or bringing about more suffering for themselves. Should we not disturb? Or from another point of view, the world is such a mess. Don't you think that we should try to do something to bring about a change of consciousness in the world so that some of these problems could be diminished? Do you think that they'll all be solved just by politics? By, you know, one government and the other government? Is that really going to solve the, you know, the cat and dog routine? Is that really going to solve the problems of the world? Or do you think that it would help for us to come to a higher stage of consciousness? How many citizens of Great Britain are dying every week in these countries where these conflicts are going on? If by bringing about a change of consciousness, something could be done about that, do you think that would be a good idea? Is it worth disturbing a few pedestrians for? Yes.
How do you preach?
Best I can. How do you mean? Depends on who the someone is, what the circumstances are. Well, I usually try to start by listening to them. A good place to start to preach is by hearing. You know, what's going on with you? What do you think? What's your idea about the purpose of life? Here's a question for you. And before we come to somebody and say, you know, the purpose of life is, to start off, what do you think is the purpose of life? Let's see what they say. Well, I think the purpose of life is to be a good person. Then you have something to talk about. I think the purpose of life is, well, whatever you think it is. You know what I mean? And the terrorists have, you know, they're doing what they think is a good idea, so it must be good. So, we listen. People are very receptive to a person, to the idea of talking about themselves, or about their views. You know, if I go up to you, you know what I think? So if I go up to you and say, you know, what do you think? Well, that must be a very intelligent person because I'm interested in what he thinks. So if you start by finding out, you know, what's going on, and then you look for your opportunity. How is Krishna consciousness relevant to that? What can you say from a Krishna conscious point of view? Like I happened to be in Ground Zero on 9/11 in New York City. And this year, not 5 years ago. And one woman was saying, the problem is that we need to be more American. We need to be more American. To the point where we should seal off our borders and not let these non-Americans come in. And so much, gee, that's an interesting idea. We have a little bit of a different idea. You know, we think that we should be less American. Or I said, you know, it seems to me that, well, you know, we make a distinction between the soul and the body, or consciousness and the body. And so we're interested more in identifying with the soul. I said, well, I believe in that too. She said, I think that the, you know, the person is like, the soul is like a crab, and the body is like the shell of the crab. Oh, yeah. I said, so which is American, the crab or the shell? The crab. You sure about that? I said, wait a second, that can't. Yeah, the crab. And so immediately there was something to talk about. You know, is the soul going to, you know, go to the American part of heaven? Is that our eternal identity? That, you know, eternally American? You know, so finding out a little something about what they think gives you something to talk about. Find out what they're interested in, and you can speak to that from Bhagavad Gita. Of course, you don't want to just sit there while they talk on and on and on about themselves, and then at the end you say, oh, that's interesting. Well, have a good day. But you're looking for the opportunity to say something relevant from Bhagavad Gita or from the Bhagavad Gita. Is that okay?
How would you approach that conversation without sounding like an authority? You know, like,
I am an authority.
maybe not to that individual.
We speak with authority. We know something. We happen to be authorities on the subject of spiritual realization. Because we've read Bhagavad Gita, we've taken some trouble to study the topic and undergo some discipline. So we happen to be authorities on the subject.
But doesn't that sometimes cause a kind of like a, who are you to tell me, how can you speak so?
Authority doesn't have to be obnoxious. Just like if I'm an authority on physics and someone's speaking something that's, you know, vague or wrong or rubbish about physics, I can say, well, actually, according to physics, you know, da 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 da. Oh yeah, well, yeah, I'm a physicist, and it's performance. Doesn't mean I have to be obnoxious.
What do you know about physics, anyway? You're not an authority on physics. I'm an authority on physics.
You know, I don't have to be a creep. But I can speak with authority. Doesn't mean I'm being egotistical, it means I happen to know something about the subject. Actually, when you know something about the subject, it can be cool. The people who don't know anything, they're trying to, like, somehow or other show that they know something. And if you actually know, you don't have to go through all that, you just know. And you can offer the information. It's not a test of egos. We just happen to be authorities on the subject.
What happens if you're preaching, but you haven't actually become like a realized person, you know, the whole manuscript?
You're an authority to the extent that you understand.
What happens if you get to a point where you're like, oh, you don't know? Do you say, I don't know?
Yep. Great answer.
And doesn't that then, because we're representing the whole of, in their eyes, we might be representing the whole of the religious community, and then by saying, I don't know, then
you become a person of integrity in their eyes. You become an honest person. They give you an argument, you say, you know, I don't know. You want to give me your email address, I'll get back to you about that. People respect it when you say you don't know. I mean, not if that's all you have to say. We We hope you know something. But when you come to a question that for which you don't know the answer, the ideal answer is, I don't know. But I'll find out and get back to you. Much better than bluffing and then being caught, you know, trying to fake it. I don't know. I'll have to look it up for you. Not God, don't need to pretend to be. Perfectly good answer.
I have no idea you were saying about principles and to maintain them. And then you said that sometimes you see that you've given up opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were working in, say, like the financial world, and you do have clients to do and make deals, how many opportunities do
you turn down? What percentage of the opportunities do I turn down?
How do you maintain?
Well, it's not that every financial deal is a gross violation of principles. But there are things that we won't do to make a deal. Things that we won't do to make a deal. If it's honest, reasonably honest, we'll do it. If it doesn't require me to sacrifice, there are lots of very lucrative financial transactions that don't require us to break our principles. I know that if I sleep with you, you'll give me this contract, but it's not worth it. I don't do that kind of thing. That's like one way that people try to get a deal. In the movie business, or the financial business, or political business, or any business. Sorry, no deal. How many of those opportunities will we forego? Lots. Depends how many they offer, that many.
Mm-hmm.
What
about
like just
taking and
flying
meals and things like that,
not as being a more moderate forms of government. You have to judge. Because there's every occupation, Krishna says, has some fault. Every occupation has some fault. There's if you're a Vaishya, you sometimes have to lie, or if you're Sudra, you sometimes have to serve a bad master. If you're a Brahmin, you sometimes have to be a priest for creepy people. Or motivated people. So whatever you do, Krishna says there's always some fault. But still we have to do our prescribed duty. So at least our minimum principles, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat eating, no this and that. But we should follow. And say, not that just to be social, have a martini with this guy. No, it's not part of our program. Other things we have to judge, things that are more subtle or more, where we draw the line. But at least it should be sufficiently out in the gray area and not, black. The black things we just don't do. The things that are just clearly against our principles. Okay, I lose my job time. There are other jobs in the world. And there are people who, they get a lot of trouble or admiration or whatever it is, but there are people who do that every day and they just say, no, I'm not going to do that because that's against my principles. I'm not going to sell out my government, or I'm not going to sell, you can make a lot of money being a traitor. But then what's your honor? You don't have any. So we don't want to be traitors to our principles. Yes? A process that we can?
Deal with our analysis, trying to do like service within the heart, so that we can cause less offense to Vaishnav, less offense to Holy Name, and less offense to Guru.
Well, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Nashta Prayeshu of Hadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevya. My service by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam regularly, by serving devotee of the Lord, the unwanted things to be in the heart are cleansed away. We have the process, it's not a secret. What do we do about it? We hear, we chant, we serve. We try to recognize these anarthas and do away with them. Lord Chaitanya compared it to gardening. You water, you weed. Well, then it becomes sense gratification. Mm-hmm. Rupa Goswami sometimes talks about that. I think Srila Prabhupada mentions it in his commentary on Nardabhakti Sutra or in the Kundamala Sutra. Prabhupada mentions that if we get into this thing, oh, I'm so fallen. You know, what's the use of me? What's the use of even chanting? I'm so fallen. You know, that becomes like sense gratification. I'm just wallowing in, self-indulgently wallowing in my own fallen condition. I'm so fallen. What's the use? I'm not going to give up and go to the pub and have a beer. So, a certain... we should be self-critical. How self-critical we see. How are acharyas? We're self-critical. Mm-hmm. From the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, mm-hmm. Narottam Das Thakur, we find that Vaishnavas can go to great, you know, quite a long way in being self-critical. But in spite of being self-critical, they don't say, well, I'm so rotten that I'm going to serve. Then you're defeating your purpose. Okay, I have all these anarthas, I have all these shortcomings, I have all these faults, but still I'll serve. And I have confidence that because I'm following the right process, eventually I'll be freed from these anarthas. They're called ashabandha, a nectar of devotion. Hope against hope. I'm so fallen, how could I ever become Krishna conscious? But the process is there. Let me follow. And then eventually, it's like a student in the beginning, you can't make out a B from a D. And we look at that and think, how am I ever going to, you know, the B's and then the D's and then there's the P's and the Q's. Mm-hmm. How can you tell? You know, they're just almost the same. And some of the letters like that, the A's and the O's look the same. How am I to remember, you know, all the, you know, which way the B goes and which way the D goes and which way the T goes? It's such a thing. But because you sit in class every day and you write patiently B, P, Q, and gradually it becomes more than possible. It's called learning. So we have to learn to make advancement in Krishna consciousness by following the process. Okay. Yeah.
When you meet a crisis, say someone's going through a really difficult situation, and you know the reason for their situation because it has happened to bad stuff, and you keep telling them over and over again.
Well, better than trying to get them to stop the bad stuff might be to try to get them to do more of the good stuff. Giving up the bad stuff, especially if you've given the advice and they've rejected it, But then, all right, take something positive. Chant more, hear more, whatever, read more, whatever it is that might be doable for them or might attract them. Do those things. That will solve, actually that will solve your problem.
What if it's a family member and they're not...
Give up, family members are homeless.
We should probably be realistic about how much mileage we can get with family members. It's not always that because we happen to be in the same family they're extra receptive or extra good candidates. They just happen to be the nearest people. Also, sometimes family members, depending on our relationship with them, are less inclined to hear about us, from us, about anything, whether we're Krishna conscious, not Krishna conscious. You know, why am I going to listen to my kid brother and his stupid opinions? You know, I'm older than he is, and why should I listen to him anyway? Or whatever it is, you know, especially parents, you know, why should I listen to my kid? You know, kid can tell me what to do. So there may be prejudices and biases in the relationship. Sometimes you may find that others may be in a better position to persuade your family member. Best thing you can do is, you know, sit down, you know, be there, the all three of you, and then tuck out while your friend talks to your family member. That sometimes works better. Yes? Yeah, you can make things worse.
Why
does this happen, that there's sometimes this heavy reaction, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to listen to you, I'm not going to do this. Partly, sometimes, we find that family members really want to exercise control. You're not going to go to that temple. You're not going to chant this mantra. You're not going to give up eating X or Y or Z. So sometimes that we may feel that we need to put a lot of distance there.
So even if, like, the parents are, they're not, like, for it themselves, but they allow the children to, like...
Well, there's something to be said for not being fanatical, isn't there? It's not that, you know, by definition, if you're a relative, you're a lost cause. Or by definition, you're to be neglected or rebelled against. Sometimes we use Krishna consciousness as an excuse to do what we wanted to do anyway. You know, I was looking for a reason to give my parents a hard time. This is as good as any other. So lots of times it doesn't have anything to do with Krishna consciousness anyway. So if we're mature, if we're thoughtful, if we're sensitive, then we try to negotiate the situation, you know, considerate manner and graceful manner, and make our family members Krishna conscious. It's not that they're by definition ineligible. Sometimes whole families become Krishna conscious. If there's one, then the next, and then, you know, domino effect, the whole family. That can happen. And therefore, Lord Chaitanya's principle is amani na manate, to be humble and to give respect to others. Not that I can't be Krishna conscious because I gave respect to someone, or because I performed some duties that I'm really obliged to do. So that takes a little maturity, a little understanding. But you can do that. That's very good. But if, on the other hand, if we become just like, well, you know, I become a perfect person in relation to my family, but I don't make any spiritual progress because I'm accommodating all of the conditions that they want to place that make it basically impossible for me to advance, or very difficult, then what did I gain? You know, I've had a nice harmonious relationship and I'm stuck in the mud. So that's not good either. So we have to do everything intelligently.
If you have a particularly pessimistic view on life generally, or pessimistic view on most things that we see, and it's hindering our Krishna consciousness, in terms of if we make some sort of advancement, we put it down to something else, like we could say, well, it's just, you're just making up in your own mind, sort of thing. Say if you feel really good about something, or you think that Krishna sent you a sign, but then you think, no, don't be silly, it's not possible. And because you're generally got a pessimistic view of life, and you don't think it can happen.
Well, it's good to be selectively pessimistic. You don't have to be too selective to be pessimistic. The world is lousy. So, to Kali Mashashvata, it's full of miseries, and even if you think it's not, it's all temporary anyway, you lose everything finally. So there's plenty, there's ample scope for pessimism. A Krishna conscious person, or a person who's interested in Krishna consciousness, will find a full field. But we shouldn't be pessimistic about Krishna consciousness. That's where we should draw the line. You can be as pessimistic as you want about the material world and still be under pessimistic. But about Krishna consciousness, we can be optimistic. It's powerful, it's coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, doesn't cost anything. So many people have become Krishna conscious by following this process. Even Jagai and Madhai became pure devotees. So why should we not be optimistic? About the world, we can be as pessimistic as we want.
My question was that Prabhupada Maharaj has given us Krishna consciousness and has given us such an amazing movement in the name of this God. I was wondering, how can we repay this debt?
Prabhupada said, preach. If you want to repay me, Prabhupada said you should preach like this. That's the only way. Distribute books. Tell people about Krishna. Bring people to Krishna consciousness, engage people in Krishna consciousness. That's the best way.
And I have one more question. I've always been confronted with people rishis and not a good thing for three times as an ex unless you're initiated. And some devotees say that it's fine, you can wear three devotees when you're not there. What did Prabhupada not say about
To me, nothing.
It's not a big deal, it's just, something.
Never told me anything
about it. Is it just concocted by people?
I don't say that. There may be a rule somewhere about two strands or three strands. Probably not the crucial issue on which Krishna consciousness will rise or fall. If you really want to wear three and you're not initiated, wear six and then compromise. This is simple, three words. okay, you have to put them in order, but it doesn't get more complicated. You can handle it. Why make life complicated? This is simple. Chant Hare Krishna, dance, eat good food, offer to Krishna. You don't want to make your life needlessly complicated. But actually make it simple. Okay. Yeah. Someone with a loud voice.
What's the word that you need to be at to worship Jagannath Devi?
What
standard
do you have to be at to worship Lord Jagannath? Can we do a mobile check, everyone? All the mobiles, put them on silent mode if you would. Unless you've got a really good ring that we should all In our homes, the standard can be very simple. Temple, the standard is quite high. Lord Jagannath is very merciful, Sri Prabhupada allowed quite a bit of latitude. So, just try to serve in that sense.
Is it initiated? Or?
Initiated, not initiated. But when you're initiated, then the actual progress becomes. But okay. Some other question? Well, one thing, of course, is that getting our ego bashed now and then is probably good for us. That's one thing. Another thing is that we may want to take advantage of those who are more experienced, who know how to have a little success with book distribution. That helps our ego a little bit if we actually succeed in distributing some books. I know I have my godbrother Vaisheshika Prabhu in America, who's very expert. He can tell you step by step, in practically three or four easy steps, what he does to distribute books. And it's not something terribly complex, and some people may do it better than others, but it works. So it's good to have some process that will work some of the time. Well, for that you have to take his seminar. But in essence, the first thing he does is he notices something about the person. That the person, there's something good about the person. I like the color of that sweater. That's really a cool color.
Well, thank you.
Or, you know, anything. He'll notice something about the person and comment on it. And that, it's astonishing actually, that people really, you'd expect everybody to say, get off it, you know. But most of the time people, you know, they're flattered. They feel like Yeah, but it is a nice car. wow, you noticed it. They've been waiting for like years for somebody. So the first thing is that he noticed something about the person, and that right away will create some sort of rapport. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the person just walks on by. But lots of times that will establish a little bit of, you know, a few moments of an opening. The person will soften. Well, yeah, I know you're flattering me, but okay. And then he'll he'll talk with them in a very simple way. He'll have some question, some idea, some presentation that a person would agree to, or that a person would think made sense. And he'll start off there. And gee, I should be able to represent this better. But we're distributing these books because we think that, you know, there's just too much fighting in the world, and really we need to, you know, to bring about a change in how people think about one another. Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm.
And of course you're looking for a yes. And one yes leads to the next, leads to the next. So you just present the book and what it's about in very simple terms. And tell people that you're giving it out, that you're distributing this book to them. And that as far as the money, it's not really about money, you just ask for a little something to kind of help print the books and just kind of give and take. You know, if they will, how much is it? So most people do this much. And it's all very smooth. You know, it's not confrontational. It's not like a fight or something. But he's the most friendly person, and he's genuinely looks to see the good part of a person and bring out that good part and offer them something that he thinks is of value. And if they don't accept it, you know, fine, you know, nice talking with you. Tries to leave the atmosphere clean, you know, not like, oh, you know, jerk, you should have taken it. You know, okay, he's a card and had a nice day. And that way, you know, his consciousness remains unagitated, and the so-called, when he doesn't succeed, and, you know, succeeded anyway, told him something about Krishna, gave him a card. And then some people, hey, they'll take the book. And the main thing is approaching people. You approach them, and sooner or later somebody's going to take the book. And if you really want to hear about it expertly, then you have to get a hold of Vaisheshika Prabhu's seminar. Maybe, I don't know if they're taped or videoed or something, but he's astonishingly good at being able to, you know, a lot of people are good book distributors, but he's astonishingly good at being able to explain what he does in such a way that you could also do it. You could ask about that. See if his seminars are available. It's very good. Mm-hmm.
Marge, it's important to be patient and enthusiastic in spiritual life. I'm quite impatient. I'm just wondering, is there any way to overcome this?
Yeah, there is, but it takes a long time. Anything good may take some time. Farmers have to be patient. Pregnant women have to be patient. Everybody has to be patient.
But if it's our constitutional position and it's just dormant, and, you know, we're trying to reawaken it, shouldn't be a bit quicker?
Well, that's good. To be a little impatient is also good. There's, on one side, you want to be patient. That means, actually, patient means just determined. means not just that, well, I'll sit around and wait for something to happen even if it takes 100 years, but I'll stick with it even if it takes 100 years. There's a difference there. It's not just passive patience, but it's determined patience. I'll stick with it. Sooner or later, it'll succeed. That's different from the previous round. That's the mode of goodness. That's also one of the characteristics. One stays with it. It's my duty. I'll stay with it.
Okay. And then someone said, why can it not happen sooner?
Yeah.
Someone said, why can it not happen sooner?
Well, why can't we get the sun to rise at 5 in the morning instead of 6:30? And it's take their own time. Why isn't every patient in the hospital cured 5 minutes after he walks in? Takes some time. Bill Gates didn't make $1 million in the first week. Everything takes time.
Do you think we can make it back in the flesh?
The prophet said we could. Yes, we can make it. And even if we don't, all right. So, for me, well, if I can't make it in this lifetime, I might as well give up. We'll never make it that way. But yes, in this one lifetime, probably you think clear. In this one lifetime, you should be pushing. That means, again, determined patience. Not, well, it happened to have, you know, like this, when he desires. Meanwhile, not much time. Yeah.
When doing certain services, if you find yourself falling quite deeply into the mode of passion, for example, group distribution or promoting an event or a program, is it that you distance yourself from the service and pick something that doesn't require you to kind of not require you but doesn't result in you in going into that mode, or should you?
Well, that requires some judgment, and it may not be your judgment. You may want to consult others also. There are some services that will suit us better. And some people really will do best in book distribution. For some people, book distribution might be something that they do sometimes, and it kind of keeps them humble, and you know, they never become very great at it, but they do it. It's a lot. It keeps them life in their contact with the public and not just be off in an office somewhere. But it may vary. You know, some people are the best in a little room doing something quiet. Some people are best, you know, front and center. And some people, you know, put them in management. Oh my God, you know, they'll cause every problem in the book. You know, there'll be all these tensions and relationships. There'll be clashes. There'll be money misspent. There'll be, you know, and some people are not managers. So put a non-manager into management may not be the best idea. So there's something to be said for being situated in a way that is most conducive for your own service to go on nicely. And then there's also, you know, what needs to be done. You know, in war, they try to put the guys who are the best gunners by the guns, and the guys who are the best signal guys in the signal corps. But sometimes, you know, you're the cook, but they need a guy with the guns. You know, well, I'm sorry, I just cook. You know, if the enemy runs all over us, but you know, I'm a cook. You know, sometimes the cook grabs the gun. So that's, you know, an extraordinary thing for me. But, is that okay? Does that answer your question?
So are you saying that even if you're good at a service, if it puts into the wrong mode, do it anyway.
Am I saying that? No, I'm not quite saying that. every service will have some downside. You know, generally, it's doing what I'm good at. There's a lot to be said for that. You know, for doing what I'm good at. I'm good at it for a reason. And what I'm good at usually carries with it the downside of whatever it is that I'm good at. You know, leaders tend to be sometimes the take charge kind of people, but sometimes they take too much charge. The people who are in some other thing, they have some other kind of problem. So there's always, we always have to deal with our natures, we always have to deal with our shortcomings. So we should be situated in the best service under the guidance of superior persons, spiritual masters, senior devotees. And then we should deal with our own shortcomings, which will appear wherever we are. There was another question?
Yeah, I'm just going to go right back to the beginning of Islam in the West. Devotees have different opinions. Some of them think, you know, Islam versus God is good, and the West are bad because they promote certain things. Some devotees say that Islam started off with that kind of violent tendencies, and it's quite intolerant. And if you, you know, tell your son to go out and devote you, while the West, they're quite tolerant because you can preach to them. So what would be the correct or perspective?
Well, what would be the correct perspective? That's not for me to say. I wouldn't say that there is a correct perspective, where, as you said, different devotees have different views, and it's everyone's individual. There's diversity. It may depend on your, you know, which Islam you're in touch with. Islam in Malaysia is very different from Islam in Saudi Arabia, different from Islam in Turkey, different from Islam in the UK. So, just like Krishna consciousness. And under the name of Krishna consciousness, you find a broad spectrum of people doing a broad spectrum of things. So, there may not be just one answer as to what Islam is, or how we should regard it. There are historical questions about the role of violence in Islam, and everybody knows it, including Muslims. And those may be issues of concern. There's also God consciousness in Islam. You know, see, walking on the streets of the Middle East, you see people who are chanting on their beads, really, the holy name of God. You know, not many people in the Pentagon chanting the holy names of God. So there's, you know, everything, there'll be some good qualities and some faults. We offer that people of any religion, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Hinduism or whatever it is, can take advantage of what Lord Chaitanya is offering. And to observe, to chant the holy name of God, to observe some principles of self-discipline, yeah, that will be good for everyone. Doesn't matter. It's not sectarian. We're not sectarian side takers. Hinduism is good. You know, Hindutva. Yeah, what is this Hinduism? I don't even know. And that Islam is bad. I told the story last night. This was told to me by a publisher in Bombay. There was some big cricket match. India-Pakistan cricket match. Yeah. Highly competitive. And the Pakistan team in the final, you know, finals, they just lost terribly. They just blew the game. would ask. So then the television reporter interviewed the captain of the losing team, and now, you know, they have to go back to Pakistan with their, you know, tails between their legs. So they interviewed the captain, and the captain began by saying that first I'd like to thank Allah for everything he's done for us. And then they interviewed the captain of the, you know, the Indian team. We had a really great team, and we all worked together, and everybody was really trying their best. So we're not in favor of Hinduism or Islam, we're in favor of God consciousness. Krishna conscious, how can that person make me Krishna conscious? Yeah. What will I learn by interacting with this person that will help me become more advanced? Because it may not be that in every circumstance, you know, hi, I'm from IBM, what do you know about Krishna? You know, that just may not fly either with your customer or with your boss.
Can you make any recommendations for us about any meditations that you can take into the workplace, you know, which might help to at least this move if you can't display another more.
You know, I'm really the wrong person to give you a particular meditation from, you know, my vast experience in the workplace. If it were me, my meditation would probably be, I gotta get out of here. I would say you might want to take advantage of the experience of other devotees who are, you know, successfully navigating that space.